Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning I want to start doing a series of lectures on a text called Kato from the Shobogenzo. Shobogenzo means true Dharma eye, and Kato means twining vines or complications. And this was written in 1243. So this is one of Dogen's more well-known fascicles. So I thought that I'd start talking about it. I'm teaching this fascicle in San Francisco. I go up there once a month and teach a three-hour block of time. And Tom's in that group. Tom, I'll try to make this a little less geeky than we... Anyway, I thought it'd be nice to start talking about Kato here. So let's start out by talking about the meaning of the title. So what Kato refers to is two twining vines. So usually it's kudzu vines. So kudzu vines, you know those vines that have taken over the South, right? And they completely cover trees and things like that. So those are kudzu vines. And then wisteria. So we all know what wisteria is. We have a fair amount of it around here. So the idea is that you've got this wisteria and kudzu. And in Zen, the idea is not that the kudzu chokes and kills the wisteria. It's this sense of the two vines, this tree and the vine are... two plants supporting each other, right? That they are, and actually it's interesting because they've discovered that the kudzu and the trees that they attach themselves to, there's actually a chemical relationship going on between the leaves and things, so that it really is kind of a symbiotic relationship. It's not just that the tree is something the kudzu can attach itself to, but that there's actually some kind of chemical process going back between the trees that they're on and the kudzu vine. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And but in generally, it refers to things being complicated, right? So when we say twining vines, we're talking about the kind of complications of what it is to be a human being in this world, right? I mean, life can seem rather complicated. Complications also more about this way in which we are in these interconnected, interpenetrating relationships just for the sustenance of our life, right? That we're not just, it's not just all about just us. So this way of being complicated in a good way would be a way in which we live in this complementary, dependent relationship, interdependent, interpenetrating relationship with all of life. So this is a kind of complication that we could say describes reality. Right? This is what reality is. And certainly from a Zen point of view, this is how we, not just how we describe reality, but how we describe enlightenment. We describe enlightenment as this way in which we are able to actually incorporate, respond to the complications, this inner connection of all of life, and that we can respond to that in a way that's wholesome and respectful of all those kind of different moving parts, if you will, of reality itself. So when we're able to do that, we find equanimity. We're able to, for example, if we are able to actually incorporate and understand, accept, if you will, impermanence in our life, from that comes a kind of wisdom and equanimity. It doesn't mean that we don't grieve over loss, but it means that we have a different relationship that's not entirely based on fear or denial about the fact that things change, that things are impermanent. So we find equanimity in the midst of this. This is the source of our wisdom. And it's the source of appropriate response. So these complications or this way that we practice with our life. So those are some definitions. There are more here. We can't exactly describe this, what life is like. We can't. This is kind of inevitable, this way of talking about how are things complicated? How are things dependent upon each other? How are things manifesting in relationship with each other? So sometimes it's difficult. We try, but it's not possible to actually describe the totality of this with words. Even if we describe it with words and we say, you know, everything's interconnected, well, that in a way just sort of is skipping over the top of what that means. So when we say that and then we stop and we think about that, you know, then we can come up with more words and more examples of how that is. And yet at some point, it's about the heart. At some point, it's just about our body sense of knowing what it is to live in this world. At some point, it's just going deeply into our lives. In some point, this is Zazen. This Zazen of just sitting in the midst of our life and being completely open and a willingness to be present for what is in this moment. That's kind of the interesting thing to me. I find this kind of fascinating about Zazen, even though I've been doing it for a very, very long time. It's always still really this sort of fresh event. Every period of Zazen feels fresh. Sometimes fresh, not so nice fresh. Sometimes fresh, great fresh. But it's a new, you know, because each moment is actually different. Each moment is something different. So this way in which we just sit ourselves down in the midst of our life and open ourselves up to what's actually happening. You know, what is this? That is another way to talk about these twining vines and this complication. In Zen, it also points to intellectual convolutions, right? This way in which we trap ourselves in our intellect. So it's this way in which we get caught. One of the definitions of kato is unnecessary, indirect, meandering, or torturous. So, this way, you know, that we can get caught in that. You know, we're like trying to figure things out, figure them out. We think we've got the story going. We figured out what it is. It's this convoluted whole, you know, sort of torturous, meandering dialogue or narrative about the nature of our experience. And then, you know, life comes and just is in this moment. So this way in which we, you know, we have to drop all that. So that's what we're doing in our practice. And Zen's famous for that, right? Just this, just this. Say, what? What is it? So this way that we just come back. And in that way, even in the midst of the complications, we're still completely dropping and being present for our life as it is, accepting, incorporating, learning from the nature of those difficulties. So we say, traps and snares cannot keep us for long, cannot catch us for long. So this way that we just keep coming back. And even in the midst of feeling like we're trapped and we're ensnared by our own delusion, at the same time, that very delusion is what frees us eventually. Because our willingness to be in the middle of our lives, in the middle of these problems, in the middle of these complications, that's where our wisdom comes from. If we had no problems, we would have no, for example, we'd have no empathy. Don't we have empathy because we are live life? The older we get, the more we realize, oh yeah, I'm not perfect, you're not perfect, I can still be your friend. You know, this way in which we realize, oh, it's like now I know what it's like to suffer. Now I know what this is about. Now, you know, I know what it is to lose a friend. So this way that we can have empathy and wisdom and realization just by looking at our own lives and our own problems. It also refers to, and this is an awful lot what Dogen's talking about in Kato, it refers to student-teacher relationship. So it refers to this way in which students and teachers are entwined with each other. There's this way that we as Sangha, all of us are entwined with each other. We come and we do this practice together, and we experience the practice together, and we struggle with each other sometimes, And sometimes everything is just perfect. It's all going along really smoothly. But there's this way in which we make this effort with each other. We come and we sit Zazen together. And in that way, sitting Zazen, there's this way in which we feel like we're having these, maybe having these internal kind of struggles, right, while we're sitting, if we're having a difficult period of Zazen. But there's this way in which, that we don't usually think about, there's this way in which we're in a room with other people, right? We're in this mandala with all of these other people. And this mandala is also a real thing. So you may feel like you're just sitting on your little cushion, you know, like, you know, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I'm not doing this right, or whatever it is, you know, or you're sitting there going, oh, cosmic man, you know. So whatever that spectrum is that we're engaged in, at the same time, we're all in this room together. This morning when you're sitting Zazen, at the same time, all of us are sitting Zazen together. All of us are these entwining vines with each other in this relationship, in these complications, if you will. So this way that we are intimate with each other. So this is also true of the student-teacher relationship. And there's this way in which, as we are thrown together and practice together, we don't really know, in some ways, what's happening. We have some idea, right? And sometimes that can be the meandering, torturous trap, the ideas that we have about what we're up to. But if we actually pay attention to and stay in, even in the midst of our delusion, we stay in what we're actually doing, then things clarify themselves. Sometimes easily, sometimes not so easily. So that's the meaning of the title of Kato. Here, that is what Dogen is talking about in this fascicle. I'll read the whole first paragraph, but I think I'm only going to talk about one sentence. Here's the first paragraph. The experience and transmission, so this is transmitting the Dharma, so this experience and transmission of the Dharma, and in this translation it says, in the order on Vulture Peak. Vulture Peak is where Dogen gave many of his, excuse me, Shakyamuni Buddha gave many of his sermons. So he's saying, the experience and transmission on this occasion with an assembly at Vulture Peak, while Shakyamuni Buddha is expounding the Dharma. The experience and transmission in the order on Vulture Peak of Shakyamuni Buddha's right Dharma eye treasury and supreme truth of Bodhi, so he's preaching the Dharma, belongs only to great Master Mahakashapa. So Master Mahakashapa is one of the major disciples of Shakyamuni Buddha, and he was present at this lecture. Authentically experienced in the transmission from rightful successor to rightful successor, it arrives at the 28th patriarch, Venerable Bodhidharma. The Venerable One demonstrates in China the behavior of a patriarch, or an ancestor, and transmits the right Dharma eye treasury and the supreme truth of Bodhi to the great master, Taisho Shisho Fukuku, making him the second patriarch. Now, I'm sorry, I'm reading this to myself, and I know what it's about. I'm thinking to myself, oh my goodness, this is so obtuse, you know. But basically what he's saying is this moment on Vulture Peak of Shakyamuni Buddha transmitting and recognizing, which I'll talk about in a second, Mahakashapa's understanding, is the beginning of the Zen lineage. And that lineage went through 28 generations until it got to Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma is considered the first ancestor in China because he brought Zen from India to China. So that's simply what he's saying here. And then Bodhidharma transmitted the teaching to the second, now the second ancestor in China, Huaiqi. That's it. That's what just got said in that paragraph. I want to talk about the first sentence, so I want to talk about Mahakashapa receiving transmission from Shakyamuni Buddha. So this is a famous story in Zen, the story of Shakyamuni holding up a flower, Mahakashapa sees the flower, and Mahakashapa smiles. So that is, in our Zen stories, that's the beginning of the Zen lineage. So Dogen starts out by telling us that Shakyamuni Buddha transmitted the Dharma, the Mahakashapa, and at the same time he acknowledged his disciple, Mahakashapa, as having deeply understood what he was transmitting. This is the twining vine between the teacher and the student in this story. This is the place that he's saying, this event, this is the fruition, if you will, of this twining vine, because Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa had been together for years. We just get this one little moment, right? We get in this story, we say, oh, on Vulture Peak, this huge assembly, Shakyamuni Buddha is preaching the Dharma, he holds up his flower, Mahakashapa smiles. That's just this one moment, and yet, simultaneously, in this one moment, there is the totality of all of their relationship, the twining vines of their relationship. There's the twining vines of Mahakashapa's life and the twining vines of Shakyamuni's life. The culture, everyone else who's present, the totality of the mandala of that experience throughout time and space, dualistically and non-dualistically, is being expressed in this one moment that we are picking out as expressing Zen, right? Expressing this ineffable thing that cannot be said, yet we say it over and over and over again. There's more literature in Zen than in any other school of Buddhism. And we like to say, oh yeah, it's a tradition outside words and letters. And this moment is an expression of that outside of the words and letters, outside the intellectual aspects of practice. So they are two twining vines, Shakyamuni and Mahakashapa. And that moment of the flower, who can say what it is? Who can say, is it Shakyamuni Buddha? Is it Mahakashapa? Is the flower? Is it the assembly? Is it the words? What? Who can say what this is? This is the totality of this moment, right this moment. And we also know every moment is a moment of awakening. Every moment, in the midst of our delusion, our awakening is just this, just this. And so, this particular moment, this thing happened. This nonverbal, complete, as we would say, transmissionless transmission. It's transmissionless because it's not linear. It's not sequential. And yet, it is about two people in a particular situation. But the moment itself, the culmination of the moment itself, cannot just be about this and this and this happen in this way. It has to be about this and this and this all simultaneously functioning together. Called that moment, flower gets held up, Mahakashapa smiles. In the Mumon Kan, which is a collection of koans called The Gateless Gate, here's how the story is told. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Vulture Peak, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent, so no one knew what to say to this. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashapa. this word entrusted is important too, because there's this way in which what is being transmitted from our point of view as Zen students and practitioners is a precious thing, right? It's a particular thing that's being entrusted to the next person. It's saying, I entrust this wisdom to you. I entrust this true Dharma eye to you. Please carry it on. I entrust you that you will carry it on. And by the way, in the Japanese of Dogen, there's this way in which there is this intimation of not knowing who entrusted whom in this story. Because there's this way in which Mahakasyapa's awakening to Shakyamuni Buddha's holding up the flower is also a verification of Shakyamuni's functioning within the context of this kato. Does this make sense? So it's like it functions both ways. Not just one way, but both ways. And that's that intimacy and interconnection and interpenetration. Everything we're doing is functioning both ways. Not just one way. It's functioning both ways. Who were you before your parents were born? So it's not just this way we tend to think about things. Now I'm going to give you a little historical note here about this story. This story is not from early Buddhism. This story was created in China. This story is part of what's called a transmission of the lamp record. They wrote a lot of these in China, because in China at that time, religion was to some extent controlled by the state and needed to be recognized by the state. And so one of the ways that the Chan school verified and claimed their recognition was through these lineage stories going way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So this story, the holding up the flower, first showed up in 1036, okay, in China, so in the 11th century. Buddha lived in like the 5th century BCE. So a lot of water had gone under the bridge before we got to this story. We don't know what actually happened. But from our point of view, you know, me telling you this story, you can see the import that it has to us as practitioners. So in some ways, Westerners, we get caught a little bit. We say, oh, well, it's not real. But it is real. This is very real. Because what we're passing on is the stories of our ancestors. We're passing on family stories. You know, like when you go to the picnic and you find out, you know, when you're 30 years old, they start really telling you about what happened in the family. You find out, oh, my uncle got some poor girl pregnant. You know, that kind of thing. Of course, these are better stories. Maybe not so juicy. So these are the Zen family stories that are being told. So if you were here last time, because Jaku lectured last week, the last time I talked was, we talked about Sendaba. Do you remember Sendaba? Sendaba was a story about the king. And Sendaba is a word that means, has four meanings. It means salt, drinking cup, water, or horse. So in the story, in Sendaba, you remember that it comes from the Nirvana Sutra. In the story they tell in the Nirvana Sutra, we always knew what the king wanted, because when he was eating and he said Sendaba, they brought him salt, right? Or when he was bathing and he said Sendaba, you could see the bathtub was empty and maybe water was the thing that was needed. You know, so there's this way in which it was really clear. If the king was planning on going, traveling down to the next town, and he said, Sendaba, they knew that was okay, bring the horse. So there was no kind of mystery about this. So it wasn't so hard to figure out what it was that they wanted. And then you remember we talked about the story about the Zen master who was asleep and the students came in. And the Zen master said, well, you know, I had a dream, and let me tell you about the dream. And then a student went and got tea. So that seemed kind of like a non sequitur, but Dogen says, oh, this is the true mystical power in Jinsu, because this, the power is that the student and the teacher are so intimate, the student knew that before the story got told, it would be good to have some tea. Before the story got told, it would be good for the teacher to be able to rinse off his face with a wet towel. And then remember the other students outside, hanging outside the other disciple, and he comes in, can't remember what he brought, something else, and they said, oh, you've got the magic power too. And he says, yeah, I was outside the door, I heard you all. So there's this way in which this reciprocity is happening. So in that case, it was a little more unclear about how that was actually happening compared to the Sundaba story, where it was so clear what the king wanted based on the context. In the Zen story, the context is a little harder to discern. And remember, we had the red herring of the dream, in a way, that kind of got us off track. Like, well, wait a minute, shouldn't he stop and listen to the dream? So in this story, this is very much like the Sundaba story. You know, we have the flower being held up. And then Mahakashapa smiles. Like, he just knows in that moment. But his smile is a totally spontaneous smile. So it's not like he's sitting there saying, oh, the blue Buddha held up a flower. And, okay, yeah, that's how the story goes. I'm going to smile now. It wasn't like that. It was like, somehow for him, in that moment of the Buddha holding up the flower, it brought him joy. Somehow it completely encapsulated that moment for Mahakashapa and that moment for Shakyamuni. And that was the complete appropriate response. That was the Sundaba of that moment, which was, smile. I just feel this. I'm going to smile in this moment. And essentially, that's what we're all trying to do in practice. So it may be a smile. It may be going to get water. It may be bring my horse. It may be now I need to listen. It may be now I need to respond and say something. We don't know. I could just give you a bunch of examples, but ultimately it's about this entwined relationship, these complications, this kato of our lives with each other that we are able to know. You know, horse, salt, water, towels, smiles. What is it? What is it that I need to do in this moment? So sometimes we don't know what the right response is. Sometimes we do know what the right response is. But what this story is about, it's about this way in which there's no gap, right? There's no gap. So that's what we're trying to work on, is the no gap. And at the same time, I think gap's okay. At the same time, there's this way in which we're like going, what do I do? What is the right thing to do? At the same time, there's a moment of, uh-oh, that was not the right thing to do. You know? And that's that complication where we say, oh, yeah, man, I really screwed that up. And we're sitting at home saying to ourselves, oh, that was so stupid. Or I'm still caught because I just want to blame that person that I feel bad. Or whatever it is that we're going through. And then we bring out, hopefully we start to practice with that. You know, we start to say, how is that? How is that? What do I need to do in this situation? How do I work with that? How do I uncomplicate this complication that I've created through my own complications? You know? And then that's part of this practice too. I mean, we wish that we could always do the right thing. We wish we could always, flower goes up, we smile, next. But unfortunately, it's not always like that. So there's this way for us that we have to figure it out sometimes. But a lot of times too, it is like the flower being held up. where our response is completely the correct and right response for that moment. We don't even think about it. We just respond. So, I want to finish this by reading something from Dogen from a fascicle that he wrote called Gyoji, which means sustained or continuous practice. And since I want to keep talking about this, like maybe even the rest of that paragraph, so next time, I want to tell you this Dogen, in this part, I think, he's saying in a really wonderful way why it is that we care about the practice of our ancestors, why it is that we care about this. He says, in the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, that's the way we're following. In the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, there is always unsurpassed, sustained practice. And this unsurpassed, sustained practice is our practice. Our practice is not different. The way, he's saying, and that is the way circling round without being cut off, circling round without being cut off, the sustained, continuous practice, like a great, he doesn't say this, but like a great full moon, right? The great full moon. Bringing forth the mind of Bodhi, so that's the desire for awakening, bringing forth the mind of Bodhi, practice Bodhi itself as awakening, and nirvana. This is being brought forth simultaneously in our practice. For Dogen, all four of these things, which we tend to think of as sequential, are simultaneous. The moment that you have the thought of realization, nirvana is present. The moment that you you practice, nirvana and Bodhi mind and Bodhi mind awaken is present simultaneously. So there's nothing left out. Dogen said in Shoji, he says, birth and death are nirvana. Birth and death are nirvana. Okay, so sustained practice, the way circling round without being cut off, bringing forth the mind of Bodhi, practice Bodhi awakened and nirvana without the slightest interval. Sustained practice is the way circling around. Therefore, it is not something we force ourselves to do or that others force us to do. It is a sustained practice that has never been defiled. The merit of this sustained practice maintains the self and maintains the other. The point here is that in our practice, around the earth and throughout the heavens in the 10 directions, everything receives its merit. So this is this sustaining practice of the whole universe, every being, everything that you can name, everything you can see, what you cannot see, what you do not know, what you know, everything is engaged in this practice of sustaining the way. So the point here is that in our practice around the earth and throughout the heavens in the 10 directions, everything receives its merit. Although the other may not be aware of it, and we may not be aware of it, it is so. So this is that practice of Kato. This is the practice of the Buddhas and ancestors. And we are not separate from that. These are our tribe, if you will. So that's why this practice, these stories are a guide for us about what we're up to. They're a guide about what it is itself. And also there's this aspect of it, which is when we call forth the Buddhas and answers, they stand with us as all of reality stands with us, next to us. We can't see it, but we call it forth. And by calling it forth, it sustains our life. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.